Hi everyone! Before I get started with today's episode, I'd like to share a quick reminder that my next episode will be a mailbag edition of Abridged Presidential Histories. I'll be honest, this is a little bit so I can catch up after some major life events. There was a 2-month stretch this summer when I got married, went on a honeymoon, started a new job, caught COVID, and bought a house. Yeah, all in 2 months, and I'm still playing a bit of catch up. After this mailbag episode, we'll get back to regularly scheduled programming with Warren G. Harding. So, if you want to throw some questions my way for the mailbag episode, don't be shy. You can reach me on Twitter at APHpodcast, via email, abridgedpresidentialhistories@gmail.com, or you can leave your questions in a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. I look forward to answering your questions. And now, our final episode on Woodrow Wilson. Enjoy! Welcome to the Abridged Presidential Histories with Kenny Ryan, episode 28E, an interview on Wilson's wives with Paul Brandis. I'm excited to welcome Paul Brandis to the show today. Paul is a White House correspondent and author of several books on the presidency, including Under This Roof, A History of the White House and the Presidency, and a book about Jackie Kennedy. Today, we're going to talk about a different president's wives, Ellen Axon Wilson, Woodrow Wilson's first wife, who died while he was in office, and Edith Bowling Galt Wilson, who Woodrow met and married roughly 1 year after the death of his first wife. If you listened to my episode on Wilson, you noticed I talked a lot more about Wilson's wives than I have about just about any other president's spouses, because they played such an important role in his presidency. Paul, thank you so much for your time.
How are you? Pleasure, Kenny.
Thank you. Thank you so much. First off, a bit of context that I think would be helpful. I know that early in the Republic, presidential spouses had very important social roles. They organized the balls and galas that were kind of the social lubricant of Washington, D.C. Today, it's common for presidential spouses to have causes that they're very passionate about and that they kind of campaign for. What was the role of presidential spouses in the early 20th century, both during maybe campaigns or once in the White House?
Well, you make a good point in delineating between the early first ladies, and they weren't called first ladies back right. then, but they were called everything from, you know, Madam President to on and on and on. But there's a big difference between first ladies then and now, as you say, in our modern era. First ladies have done everything from, you know, beautification projects, Lady Bird Johnson cleaning up the highways and things like that, to Nancy Reagan's just say no to drugs. And Barbara Bush was big on literacy. And Laura Bush, in fact, was a former school librarian, was big on reading and things like that. Not so much. That is more of a kind of a recent phenomenon. And by recent, I mean, say, the last half century or so. Prior to that, the job of most first ladies, as a sexist country, I suppose you could say that, only until the last half century or so. And the role of a first lady, as it was for women in general in the United States, were largely subservient to their husbands. Mamie Eisenhower, for example, was there to serve her husband, take care of his needs, and so forth. Bess Truman, who hated being first lady, was there to help take care of Harry. One exception, one major exception, could be Eleanor Roosevelt, of course, probably the greatest first lady, who had a life of her own beyond Franklin Roosevelt. She had a newspaper column and a radio show and traveled widely and just supported all kinds of causes. She was the outlier, though. The norm prior, again, to the last few decades or so, was generally for first ladies to be supportive of their husbands. And that extends, of course, to the Wilsons. Wilson's first wife, as you noted, died, and the president met Edith about a year later, and they dated for a respectable period and then got married. And Her story, which I know we're going to get into, is quite interesting, given the onset of the First World War and then Wilson's nearly fatal stroke that he had in 1919 that thrust her into a new and frankly unexpected role as First Ladies. But the main point here is that First Ladies in general were largely supportive of their presidential husbands until the last half century ago, when they've kind of come out into their own with their own different causes to support.
Yeah, thank you for that context and hinting at Edith, who's really going to have an interesting story to get into.
Sure.
And I think to even better appreciate it, let's talk about the Wilson's relationship with Ellen, his first wife. Can you tell me a little bit about what that relationship was like?
Well, when we think of Wilson's wives, we generally think mostly of Edith, who was First Lady for most of Wilson's presidency, but it was really Ellen who was married to him longer. She was also the mother, of course, of their three children. Ellen Wilson was very refined, art, music, literature, but especially art. They met back in 1883 when Wilson was visiting Georgia on some family business, I believe. He was 27. She was 23, so about a four-year age gap. He was smitten with her, just beautiful, he thought. He particularly loved her eyes, and they were engaged within a couple of months. He just adored Ellen. He wrote her literally hundreds and hundreds of letters, maybe even a few thousand, just gushing with this admiration for her. He was just smitten with his wife. They were married in 1885, so it wasn't a long romance. She gave in pretty quickly, and within 4 years, they had three daughters. She kind of put her artistic career, her artistic interests aside to take care of him and their daughters. But as the girls began to grow up, Ellen began to return to art in the summer of 1905. She spent an entire summer at a pretty famous artist's colony in Connecticut. She was really a very good painter, just quite accomplished. When they went to the White House, he was elected, of course, in the famous election of 1912, the famous three-way election. It was Wilson and two former presidents. It was Taft and Theodore Roosevelt. Quite an amazing election. When they went to the White House, she worked to improve the horrible living conditions of African Americans in Washington. She also, and a lot of people might not know this, you know, the famous Rose Garden that sits outside the West Wing, she actually turned it into the Rose Garden. It was a garden, but it didn't resemble anything like it does today. Well, she was responsible for that. So that is one of her huge accomplishments. And it's really amazing, given that Ellen Wilson was only First Lady for, I think, about 16 months. He was inaugurated in March 1913. She died in August 1914 of Bright's disease. So just 17 months in the White House. And on her deathbed, she told her husband, the president, that she hoped he would remarry. So a tragic end to what had been, by all accounts, just a wonderfully loving marriage between Woodrow and Ellen Wilson.
And Ellen, unfortunately, we talked about it, she became sick and she died August 6th, 1914 of Bright's disease, right in the middle of like the week that starts World War One. You know, like people are declaring war days before she dies, people are declaring war the days after she dies. What impact did her death have on Wilson during this pivotal moment?
Well, it's interesting that the date is interesting, August 6th, 1914. And that was right at about the time when, as you pointed out, the Archduke Francis Ferdinand was assassinated in Sarajevo, the shot that really started what at the time was called the war to end all wars. Unfortunately, it didn't turn out to be that. But the timing is so interesting. I mean, he was devastated. by that. He was a widower president. He was very lonely. He needed a partner. He was devastated by that. I think it was good that he was quite distracted by his job, which obviously got much more serious with the start of the war. And of course, the United States stayed out of the war until 1917. But during those 3 years when the U.S. was neutral, 1914 to 1917, there was increasing pressure on the United States to come in on the side of the Allies. He resisted, and not unlike Franklin Roosevelt a generation later, he said, "We're not going to get involved in a foreign war. Our boys are not going to be fighting on European soil," that kind of thing. That went down the tubes pretty quickly after the famous Zimmerman telegram, which was intercepted and given to Wilson. And for anyone who doesn't know that, it's really a quite interesting, very bold effort by the Germans to draw Mexico into the war against the United States. And as an inducement to bring Mexico into the war, they said, "Well, if we win the war, then you're going to get all the territory that you lost during the Mexican-American War in the 1840s. Quite an interesting offer. The Mexicans did not get involved in the war, but it angered Wilson so much that combined with other things like the sinking of the Lusitania, which killed, I think, about 128 Americans of the 1,500 or so that were on board. It was just like a boiling kettle. Just the heat got too much, and eventually U.S. did, in fact, get into the war.
So it took Wilson a bit to get over the loss of Ellen, but when he did, he seemed to kind of go from bereavement to hound dog in a hurry. In March of 1915, about 7 months after Ellen's death, Woodrow met Edith Galt, a widow, 16 years younger than him. Can you tell me about how they met and how this relationship started? What was it like being courted by the president? You know, is there any part of this relationship that has to be kind of secret for political reasons? Are they just out in the public, in the talk of the town? I can only imagine you'd get so much scrutiny if you're publicly dating the president. So what was that part of it like?
Well, I think after his wife died, there was an enormous amount of public sympathy towards him. And he waited a respectable period of time to start dating again and socializing again. But the main thing is that, there was a great amount of sympathy towards him. And also in those days, the press was not like the press that we have today, which was watching presidents 24/7 and reporting on every little tiny thing they do. The press was actually somewhat removed from the White House and presidents in those days. There was obviously no television. The pictures were hard to come by, that kind of thing. So they had a lot more privacy than, say, a widower president today might have. My God, trying to think of a president, the single man bachelor president dating today. Man, what a tough job that would be. But back then, it was much easier because they had, again, there was more privacy. The media coverage really wasn't, anything close to what it is today. And people were also more deferential to presidents back then than they are today. I mean, today we just rip them for every little tiny, you fall off your bicycle like Biden did a few weeks ago, and it's a huge deal and pictures everywhere. The press was, largely deferential to presidents back then, and that certainly played to Wilson's advantage as they dated. So they had their privacy again. They could drive around all over Washington and take in the sights, and they would have picnics and this kind of thing on the banks of the Potomac. And it was as normal as could be for the president of the United States and his girlfriend.
And so, as we mentioned, they get to have a few really nice years together. And then everything gets turned on its head on October 2nd, 1919, about a year and a half left in his term. Wilson suffered a debilitating stroke. And this is where some historians start to say Edith became so powerful that you could almost consider her the first female president. So let's really break this down. Like, what's happening? What happens to their relationship? What happens to Edith's role? What happens after Wilson suffers this stroke?
Well, it was really, in retrospect, one of the biggest cover-ups in American history.
Yeah.
The Senate shoots down his proposal for the League of Nations. He's angry about that. He goes on this nationwide railroad tour to drum up support for it. And he's out west and wasn't feeling well. And so he was taken back to Washington. He might have died, in fact, on that Western trip if he had kept up this grueling pace. But Dr. Grayson and others said, well, you have to go back to the White House and get some rest. Let's just forget about this tour. So the train rushes back to Washington, and he's back in the White House. And it wasn't too long after that when he collapsed with a near fatal stroke. And he was found in the bathroom by Edith. She summoned Dr. Grayson. And when Dr. Grayson saw him, he sprawled out on the bathroom floor. His first thought was, my God, the president is dead. He looked terrible. He couldn't speak. He was paralyzed on one side. He could barely move. And they just freaked out. They didn't know what to do. They put him to bed. And it was the beginning, as I mentioned, of a huge cover-up. They did not want the American people to know about this. They did not want members of Congress to know about this. They did not even want a lot of White House staffers to know about this.
And who's they? Is they Dr. Grayson and Edith? Is it like the cabinet? Who's at the heart of this?
It was largely Edith and Dr. Grayson and a few other very close aides. They wanted to protect the president, and not because he was on the verge of a death, frankly. The stroke was so bad, it's a miracle that he even survived. So they decided to, I think cover up is a reasonable word, just because they didn't want anybody to know about it. The press was, which I mentioned, was kind of at a distance anyway throughout the presidency. It was really kept in the dark. The vice president didn't really know that much about it. It was just extraordinary. And the big question that historians have always wondered is, some say that Edith became sort of a de facto president, making decisions and signing papers and so forth on his behalf. She wasn't really the acting president, but basically what happened was that I wouldn't say that it was a power grab. Her principal focus, as I mentioned, was she didn't want anything to impact his health adversely. She didn't want to be president, but she didn't want anyone to disturb him either. So Dr. Grayson said to her, well, Mrs. Wilson, before he was stricken, he had been kind of, you know, briefing you on the issues and keeping you up to date on the war and so forth. Perhaps you can help by signing documents on his behalf and everything. And so for the last year and a half of his presidency, practically no one saw the president. He was able to sign documents as he got better and began to recuperate, but he didn't really see any papers, sign any papers, until they had first gone through her. She was sort of the gatekeeper, if you will. And by the way, there's one thing I forgot to mention when you said, what did he do when they were dating? I forgot, and this was a huge security thing. He actually shared classified documents with her.
Oh, wow.
Concerning the war and other things as a way of kind of impressing her. Again, that's kind of something that, you or I couldn't do if we were dating someone, but hey, it's the president, and he said, hey, take a look at these documents. Boy, that would be a really serious matter if a president did something like that today. I mean, presidents, And wives today obviously have discussions about things like that, but they certainly don't share classified documents about the national security issues, or at least I hope they don't. Right. But that's what he did. And it was, it was the kind of thing that would only come out until years later. So that's one thing that he did. But anyway, but back to his illness, as he got better, she was really the gatekeeper for everything. But this talk that she was kind of the acting president, that's not really true. I mean, cabinet officials got involved and things like that. But it was really quite an amazing, I think, the most glaring cover-up in American history. I don't think it could happen today just because the press is, I'd say they're in the building. That wasn't the case back then. They're far more intrusive today. And cameras are everywhere, which wasn't the case back then. Yeah. So it was quite an extraordinary moment in American history.
And I'm curious, can you elaborate a little bit more on her role in this kind of cover-up? Like, is this like a Weekend at Bernie's thing? She puts sunglasses on him and it's like, look, my husband's fine. You know, is it just nobody comes in? What does this cover-up look like? And especially in how she supports it. Is she lying to people? Is she telling people he's great? He's just sleeping, you know?
It's hard to cover up something like that with words like that. You can't say that he's yeah. well when he's hardly seen. I think people had an understanding that something was wrong, that he in fact was not well. And what didn't take much to deduce that, because he wasn't seen in public. He had just, again, remember, just before his stroke, he'd been on this deeply intensive railroad tour, giving speeches every day and giving interviews to newspapers. He was just hyperactive in pressing the case for, again, the League of Nations. And all of a sudden, there's nothing. So I don't think it took much for people to understand that something was wrong here, but they didn't have access to him. She was his constant attendant. She was with him all the time. She took over a lot of routine details and, day-to-day things that the government was doing. But she would obviously, cabinet officials would do a lot of that and just kind of keep her briefed as to what was going on. And then she would brief the president. But contrary to what a lot of people think, she did not make major decisions. She did not initiate programs or anything like that. She did not try to exert control over the executive branch. Again, her principal focus was protecting her husband. Mm-hmm. She was very select about who could get in to see him. It was a very short list. She was very selective, as I mentioned, about documents that he could see. And that was it. She let everything else, again, go to cabinet heads or heads of various departments and agencies, just let them run the show. It was kind of a very decentralized form of government, perhaps, might be a good way of putting it.
There's one thought that's kept like jumping into my mind when I think about this claim of Edith, the first female president, and kind of where it might be coming from. And it kind of comes down to this last year and a half, when Wilson's debilitated from a stroke, are really rough years for the administration and the country. You know, this is a time period when there's race riots, when there's inflation, the economy's awful, like everything's terrible. There's the first Red Scare, people are being deported, there's anarchist bombings. Like, it's a really, really rough time. And part of me wonders if any of this, of people saying, oh, Edith's the first female president, she's really in charge then, is almost like a sexist deflection, almost a see what happens when a woman's in charge, or it's not the guy's fault, it's Edith's fault, because she was in charge. Do you think there's anything to that, or am I just being imaginative?
Well, people form opinions through a prism of pre-existing beliefs, I suppose. And if there are people who say, oh, that proves that women aren't capable of being president, I don't think that's true. I think there are several women in our past who I think would have been qualified presidents. I think there are several women today who I think would be qualified.
Absolutely.
But this was a century ago.
Yeah.
As I mentioned, it was a much more sexist country. Women didn't even have the right to vote until 1920.
Yeah, not till the very end. Yeah.
So, you know, it was not until 1920 that they could even vote. So that is, I think, the most glaring example of what a sexist country it was. So there might have been some resentment of the fact that she was, you know, had her finger in all these pies, I suppose, and was restricting access to him. But it is interesting that behind the White House gates, she's focused on taking care of her husband. And outside the gates, as you mentioned, a very good point, Kenny, you know, there's World War One. Well, that ended before.
Everything else is terrible.
But outside the gate, yeah, the you know, the main thing was that you know, race relations were just, you can make an edit there, but outside the White House gates, race relations were terrible. There were lynchings. There were the Palmer raids. The Attorney General, Palmer, was maybe one of the worst attorney generals in history, Alexander Palmer. He fell for this whole Red Scare business. The Bolshevik Revolution had just occurred in Russia, and there were fears of communists everywhere. You know, and these bombings led to everything, to the famous Sacco and Vanzetti trial in the 1920s, to the rise of J. Edgar Hoover, who was an aide to the Attorney General, and he was the one who proposed these stringent measures to crack down on these anarchists and everything. It was really a very bad time. There was paranoia of foreigners, paranoia about immigration. These things, this stuff sounds familiar, doesn't it? I mean, history sometimes goes in cycles. We have today, for example, fear of, you know, immigration and foreigners and all of that. Well, it's nothing new. And back then, it was just you know, part of another cycle. But it was really, as you say, a really good point. There's a lot of turmoil in the country in 1920. You know, and again, women are chaining themselves to the White House fence saying, why can't we vote? And finally, Wilson gave in and said, OK, I'll support the amendment and women can vote. And that was it. So it was a very unstable time.
Last question I'd like to ask is, how would you sum up the importance and influence of Wilson's wives?
Well, I think that that Ellen Wilson, being the mother of his three children, was quite influential in that respect, because his daughters were a calming presence in his life. He consulted them from time to time on and things, as parents and adult children sometimes do. Edith, of course, is the much more famous first lady just because of what happened after he had the stroke. It's interesting, I suppose, to wonder, what if he had never met her and never married and had the stroke anyway? What might have happened to the country? Who would have run the show? I don't know. That's an interesting question, I suppose. So you could look upon Edith as stabilizing influence too. She nursed him back to health. It was the only thing that she was concerned with. And frankly, she did a good job. I mean, he died again just not too long after, 1923, I think he passed away, just 2 years after leaving the White House. But again, if she had not been around, I wonder if his recovery might have taken even longer, or if in fact he might have even perished while in office. We'll never know. But in that regard, I think she was quite good for him. So both first ladies, Ellen and Edith, they were both good women. They first was the mother of his children. The second was the one who nursed him back to health after this debilitating stroke.
If you'd like to hear more from Paul, please check out West Wing Reports on Twitter, or pick up Under This Roof, A History of the White House and the Presidency, at your favorite bookstore. Thank you for your time, Paul.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to today's episode of Abridged Presidential Histories. If you enjoyed the show, please share it with your friends or write a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. As I mentioned at the top of today's episode, our next episode will be a Q&A mailbag, so please submit your questions on Twitter at APH Podcast, via email, abridgedpresidentialhistories@gmail.com, or write your questions in a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. And I'll look forward to answering those questions in a couple of weeks. Thanks for your support. Take care, y'all.